Hi, this is Fred Herbert, author of How to Prepare Your Business for Sale and creator of Business for Sale Blueprint. Today I'm interviewing Alex Vantarakis with the Vant Group. Alex is an expert in mergers and acquisitions, and he's going to share with us some insights that he's gained over the years of helping business owners successfully sell their business. So, Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, Alex, I want you to take a few minutes, if you would, to just tell us a little bit about yourself and your business.
Absolutely. Well, everybody always asks me, how did I get into the business of helping people buy and sell companies? And the way that it came about is I was, frankly, a pre-customer of my own. I bought and sold a business, and I enjoyed the ownership process, but I greatly enjoyed the actual buying and selling process. So after I sold my business, I joined a firm to kind of learn the ins and outs. And the next year, I went off and started my firm on my own, and have been doing that ever since.
Now, how many years ago was that?
I bought my business in 1998, and I started the Vant Group in 1999. And we've gone through the ups and downs. We at one point we had 10 different brokers that were working for us, and now we've narrowed that down so that I can work on deals rather than managing people, which is, I much prefer to work on with business owners, helping them buy and sell companies. So I've reduced our workforce, and now I get to work on all the deals by myself with my staff.
Oh, interesting. Well, Alex, I'm expecting that most of the people listening to this, well, there's going to be a wide variety of business owners listening to this audio, some with probably pretty small businesses and some with very large businesses. And I know you've probably worked with all sizes, but what have you seen that is kind of key across all business sizes in trying to get your business ready for sale?
It's a great question. The process of selling a business is fairly similar, whether you have a small mom-and-pop business or whether you have a $100 million company. And the three things that really cross all business sizes are the following. Number one, a business has to have its business financials in order. You've got to have good bookkeeping, translating into solid tax returns, translating into good P&L and balance sheets, so that a business buyer will feel confident that the business that they're buying is represented accurately. Number two is a lot of small businesses, even the larger businesses, the owner is really the whole company. And that's not a good way to sell your company, because the first thing that a buyer does is they look at a business and think, is this a business that I can jump in and easily be able to buy and learn? Or is this something where the owner holds all the keys to the kingdom? So removing yourself from being the primary person in your business is very important, whether you have a small or a large business. And then lastly, is having a business that has recurring revenue. It's hard enough to get new sales, but to have to get it every month is a very difficult feat. So whether you're a large or small business, the more recurring revenue you have, meaning revenue that's under contract that you can predict over a couple of months, a year, hopefully multi-year, definitely makes a business more valuable and definitely makes a business more saleable.
Very good. Some of the same things I highly recommend and mention in my book. One of the things that I also recommend is, you know, business owners having a several year view and not just thinking they're going to sell the business right now and expect to get on the market and sell it in a few months. And so I try to talk my clients into having a longer term perspective and getting involved in the process early. But every once in a while, you run into somebody that they've just got to move their business right away, whether it be health issues or some other event that's causing them to have to sell quickly. If you run into somebody who wants to try to move their business very quickly, what do you recommend or some of the critical priorities that they focus on first?
Excellent question. Well, unfortunately, if a seller has to sell in a short amount of time, most of the items that you can do to increase your value have a long-term timeline rather than a short-term timeline, like some of the ones that we mentioned about having recurring revenue and so forth. if you're condensing that down to a 6-month period, I would say that the most important things, again, even though financials might take longer to put in order, having your financials and your tax returns in place are going to be your number one priority.
Mm-hmm.
Number two priority is to try to start finding somebody in the business that you can start grooming to kind of be your right-hand person if you don't already have one. And then having some sort of training material or operations manual. The goal when you sell your business, the number one thing people look for is cash flow. They want to know how much money can I make out of the business. And then the number two thing they look at is how difficult will it be for me to make that money? And the more your business looks like it's proceduralized, the more value you'll get and the more buyers you'll have looking at it. So if I only had 6 months, I'd make sure my financials were in order. I'd try to get a right-hand person up to speed, and I'd have an operations training manual in place.
Oh, very good. Yeah, I kind of like Michael Gerber's approach of running your business like it's a franchise. And so many business owners don't have all their key processes documented, and it's really good advice. I like that.
I was going to say, if you're referring to the E-Myth, that is an excellent, you know, the book isn't written for people that want to sell, but if you read that book and follow it, he's outlining all of the things that you can do to increase the efficiency of your business, which in a roundabout way increases the value of your business. So yes, absolutely. If we're doing some recommended reading, that is one that you can get a lot of bang for your buck by reading. It'll make your business better. And then when you're ready to sell, it will increase the viability and the price of your business.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So tell me a little bit about the process you go through in helping a client get ready for sell and I guess the whole sales cycle and the process.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. I just had somebody in my office today that said, we're not ready to sell today. We want to sell in 2 years. And frankly, they are being extremely diligent in their efforts, because they'd come in with the 6-month example that we referred to earlier, mm-hmm. there's not really much that they could do. So I'm going to break it down into what I tell people when they come early enough, and then what the actual process is after they're ready.
That'd be great.
The people that have time are I recommend the three things we've already discussed: financials in order, owner not being the business, and recurring revenue. That for sure. And then also, what I try to explain to them is, in order to maximize the amount of cash that you're going to get, as opposed to having to do any owner financing, that all of your books and records must be, I don't want to say legitimized, but having the fewest amount of personal perks or one-time add-backs. What do I mean by that? Most small businesses are lifestyle businesses. And in turn, a lot of people run some personal expenses that can also be deemed as business expenses. Well, the more you do that, the less net income you have on your tax returns, the harder it is to get bank financing. And a lot of people don't realize that. You know, it's the old expression, have your cake and eat it too. They want to run some personal expenses through, minimize their current income tax, but then when they wind up selling, they're not able to get as much bank financing, which increases their risk because you have to have a lot more owner carry. So the one big thing I would say is definitely maximizing your actual net income, because that will increase not only your price, but increase how much money you get up front. So let's say you've done all that and we meet and you say, I am now ready to sell. The first thing we do is we provide a business valuation to determine what is the business currently worth. And the methods that we use are obviously some financial analysis, which is taken right from your tax returns and your P&Ls. And that's pretty black and white. And that's about 50% of the value. The other 50% is from subjective items. For example, the first question I ask all business owners is, when was the last time you took a vacation? And if the answer is vacation, what is that? I can't get away. That reduces the value.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a business owner that says, vacations, oh, I take those every month for a week because my staff and my business is run so well that I'm able to do that. Well, which of those two businesses do you think is more valuable? Obviously, the one where the gentleman can take a vacation. So we go through a litany of these subjective type questions. And we add that to our financial analysis and we come up with a value. Once we determine a value and the business owner agrees with the value, we prepare an investment package or a marketing package. And this package is basically the information that a buyer would need to be able to make a decision to buy the business or not. So obviously the better that packet, the more likely we are to get buyers that are interested. So we spend quite a bit of time on that. Once we get the package into place, then a business is marketed. And with the internet the way that it is today, there's some very confidential ways and very confidential websites that we go to, where a lot of business buyers go to, and we put up a one-page teaser on those sites. We start getting inquiries, and then the real fun begins. Once you get a buyer on board, they go through due diligence. They meet with the sellers. They normally don't meet with employees or customers because it's too premature. They do their own due diligence. Then they come up with a value. Once the value is negotiated, they continue with their due diligence. And if they have the financing already lined up, then closing is fairly short. If not, then we have to go for bank financing, which could take anywhere from 2 to 3 months. A typical deal from start to finish, once you have a buyer, is roughly 4 months.
Okay. About 4 months. Now, what kind of time frame do you commonly see, though, in the whole sales cycle? I know some business owners aren't always prepared for it, might maybe taking 6 months, a year, whatever, to actually find that perfect buyer. Is there any averages that you see in the industry?
Excellent question. The better the business offering, the quicker it will most likely be to sell. So a business offering that's in an industry that's very popular with multiples and sale price that are very reasonable, those business, you know, a business can sell as quickly as 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
The businesses that take longer, I've seen businesses that have taken up to a year and a half to sell. On average, a business takes roughly 9 months from the day that you start marketing to the day you show up at closing and you receive your payment is roughly 9 months.
Okay. Now, I know you don't probably take care of the whole United States, but a question I have to ask you is here, if somebody is listening to this in another state and is trying to find the right business broker or mergers and acquisition firm, depending on the size of their business, do you have any recommendations on how they might pick and make sure they're finding the right broker?
Absolutely. I'm going to tell you 5 different areas that you need to look at when you're analyzing a business broker. And it really doesn't matter on the size of your business. These all pretty much hold true. Number one is you want to see how long somebody's been in business. The process of helping somebody sell a business, the steps that are involved are very easy to facilitate. The difference between a broker or an M&A advisor that's been doing this for a year versus 10 years is all of the small hurdles that come up in every deal that can kill a deal. And I've done a very informal study. I'm trying to track in my deals areas where I think the deal could have died. And there's usually 20 to 30 different items that can kill a deal that an inexperienced broker just won't see until it's too late. So years in business is definitely the case, more than people might expect in other industries. That's number one. Number two, is this something that they're doing full-time or is this a side business? You know, do they have an office? Is this a legitimate firm? Because, you know, unfortunately, like I said earlier, the process is very simple. So a lot of people wind up getting into the industry, and a lot of them are just kind of doing it on the side. If, you know, if it's a CPA that happens to sell businesses on the side, or if it's a person that does residential real estate that thinks that they can sell businesses. So making sure that this is their focus, that this is their actual business that they're focusing on is paramount. Number three, you really need somebody, in my opinion, with some sort of finance background. You don't have to be an MBA in finance. You don't have to be an accountant per se. But you really have to get a good understanding of the numbers, because you're providing a value, you as a broker, are providing a value to your customer based on your experience. And valuing a business, what I said earlier, 50% is from the financials. You really have to understand the financials that you're looking at. The other 50%, which leads back to experience, is subjective. If you don't have enough experience, you're really not going to be able to offer the 50% on the subjective side. Number four is making sure that people have sold businesses within the size range that your business is. Selling a $100,000 business and selling a $10 million business, or it might as well be two different languages, because they're that drastically different in terms of the buyers that you're going to see, the financials you have to understand, and the financing that you'll need to get. And then lastly, and this one's kind of interesting, is making sure, how do I say this properly? You want to pay a high commission to a broker. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, because you always want to spend the least amount of money. But the way that I look at it, and I'll take myself for an example, we have rates that we charge that are probably a little bit above average, because our success rates are very high. So not only do you want somebody that isn't going to negotiate, you don't want a broker that's going to negotiate their fee too quickly or for too little amount of money, because there's a reason why they're taking a deal for less, because they either don't have any work or that's their strategy, is to charge lower. Well, I'm not saying to pay Maserati prices, but you definitely want to pay Mercedes prices, because you want to get Mercedes-type service. We're not talking about selling a house where you can put it on MLS and basically, you know, you have hundreds of people coming to you. And the process is, you know, if the houses are selling for $100 a square feet, then you're going to get anywhere between 95 and 105 probably. When you're selling a business, there's so many variables involved. You really do want the cream of the crop working on your deal, and trying to save a point or two on commission, as opposed to finding a broker or an M&A advisor that is steadfast on their fees because they're so confident and their success rate is so high. That's what I would go after if I was selling my business. So those are kind of the five things that you really need to. And there's more, but those are the five big ones.
Okay, that is
M&A advisor.
Yeah, that is excellent advice. I appreciate that very much. Well, you kind of alluded to this already a little bit about, you know, 20 or 30 things can go wrong during the process of a sale, but what can business owners do to kind of keep some of those things from going wrong, and what are some common mistakes or things that you see that cause a deal to go bad that's really kind of the fault of the business owner themselves?
Absolutely. Number one is not being flexible. The worst thing that a business owner can do when they're negotiating is draw a line in the sand. You know, I won't take less than $1 million. Okay, so you wouldn't take $995,000 with a $20,000 employment contract, for example. I'm not willing to finance more than X percent. I'm not willing to do ABC, whatever those ABCs are. I understand what a business owner wants. Let me back up just for a second. The job of a good business intermediary is to hear what your seller is telling you, hear what the buyer is telling you, and trying to maximize what you think you can get your seller. It is not to get your seller exactly what he wants, because sometimes that's just unreasonable. And I'm going back to the point about picking a good business broker. You need to explain, just like a seller is going to rely on his attorney or CPA to give him that type of advice, and that professional is going to give them the best advice, not what the seller wants to hear. That's the job that a good business intermediary is going to make. So back to what are some common mistakes. One is not being flexible. Two is sellers stop running their business like they normally would.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens a lot. A seller gets very excited. He thinks he's close to closing. He stops selling. The deal is in front of a bank to get financing. They look at the last 3 months of revenue being down. The loan gets denied. The deal goes defunct. And that's an actual example of something that we've actually gone through. That's another point. A third point is focusing too much on the sale price itself. Sale price is one of four or five different factors that a seller needs to understand. You have financing terms. You know, would you rather sell a business for $1 million all cash or $2 million with half down and payment terms over 5 years? So terms, how long a seller has to stay around, how many employees they're going to keep, if that's important for a seller. Basically, the sale price itself, sellers just need to understand that's only one variable of the ultimate deal. Those are the big ones. The flexibility, to be frank, is by far the biggest deal breaker and deal killer in our industry. And if somebody is flexible and listens to their advisor, they will get the maximum amount that business will generate.
Oh, that's great. Now, you alluded to this a little bit already, but something that I really talk about heavily in my book and my coaching programs with my clients is understanding the buyer's perspective. You see so many business owners that are only thinking of this is what I've got to have, or I need this amount of money for retirement, and really taking that stance, and kind of maybe it goes along with your inflexibility that you just talked about, and not really understanding that you've really got to look at what the buyer is looking for in your business. So I really push that hard, and give me some thoughts on that from your perspective.
Absolutely. You know, buying and selling a business is just like negotiating anything else in life. And in order to have a good negotiator has to understand exactly where the other side is coming from and understanding what are their hot buttons. So it is very possible to get more for your business than you're asking for if you in turn offer something that's more important to a buyer than money. For example, if you're selling a business where the seller believes that you are an extremely important part of the business, then you can easily negotiate, potentially, let's say, a year of consulting included in the price if you get your full price, because that's what's important to a buyer. Well, I can tell you what happens in almost every deal like that, where the seller has negotiated a long-term consulting project. After 6 months or so, and a lot of times a lot less, the buyer decides, well, this business isn't as hard as I thought it was, and tells the seller, don't worry about it, you don't have to continue working here. So you've given something that hasn't really cost you much to get you more in the end game. So you are 100% correct on the way that you're describing it to your clients, that if you can't put yourself in a buyer's position, you can't really negotiate. And you can't start saying things like, you know, well, if he doesn't understand this, that's just too bad. And believe it or not, I hear that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like a marriage where you've really got to, you know, if you want a happy marriage, you compromise. At least those people that are happily married.
Right.
And it's the same thing with buying and selling a business. You just have to put yourself in the other person's shoes. That doesn't mean that you have to give in on a lot of items. That just means that if you can understand what their top priorities are and focus on getting those answered, you can probably find a way to get what you want ultimately in the deal.
Oh, that's great. Well, changing directions a little bit here, I'd like to talk for a few minutes about how we deal with current employees. I know that's a challenge for a lot of business owners. Do I tell my employees that, or my key leaders, that I'm thinking of selling, or should I try to keep it hush hush and do everything, without the employee's involvement? And what do you see in that? I know there's probably a lot of it depends, but what are some recommendations for business owners when it comes to employees knowing about them trying to sell the business?
So just like we're talking about business sellers needing to be in the shoes of business buyers, I tell the same thing to the buyers, that listen, when it comes to employees, you have to understand that the last thing a seller will ever want to do is tell their employees the business is sold until he has his check in hand. And I don't blame them, because a lot of things can happen. People get real nervous when a business sells. So what I tell all of the sellers is, look, employees, when they find out the business is being sold, are going to be just as nervous that they're not going to have a job as the seller and the buyer are that they're going to leave when the business is sold. So unless you have to tell one of your employees, I wouldn't ever tell an employee until the latest possible time. And I'll give you an example of when you may have to tell an employee. If you have a key employee that you've talked to in the past about potentially being a successor to the business, that person is going to be very upset if he's not told ahead of time. So the way that I would summarize talking to employees is, if it's a key employee that you have a long-standing relationship that you believe is owed a talking to, then I would talk to them. But everybody else, I would not do that, because once you tell one person, they tell another person, and then all of a sudden, everybody in the company knows.
Do you find it a challenge, though, to be able to, tour the company and show the business very, very well to a prospective buyer when the employees are not aware that the business is on the market?
It all boils down to how good your business intermediary handles the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
In 15 years, I have never had a breach of confidentiality. I have brought people by many different companies, but you never do it in a time or a way that will raise suspicion. So I'll give you an example. We have a business for sale, and this business has a lot of customers that walk in to tour the facility. So bringing somebody in the middle of the day in that business is not an issue. I have other businesses where nobody ever goes in there. And if they saw people walking around, there'd be red flags. So we bring those buyers by in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as it could be an issue, you just have to annualize your own business and figure out what's the likelihood of there being any suspicion if people are seen, and then just work around that.
Okay. Now let's talk about customers a little bit. You mentioned how important it is to have that recurring sales, or the prospective buyer having faith that the sales will continue once they own the business. What do you tell a business owner who has a real high percentage of their sales coming from just a couple of key clients? Like 80% of my business is, Walmart or something like that. And, how do you deal with those kind of situations? I know, not every business has a nice even spread of clientele. So any advice for that?
Absolutely. Fortunately and unfortunately, having a high concentration of customers is either going to be viewed as a extreme positive by the sellers and an extreme negative by the buyers. And here's why. Obviously, having fewer customers makes a seller's life a lot easier in terms of management, accounting, payroll. It's much easier to have four customers that are all 25% of your business rather than have hundreds of customers that you have to deal with. And a seller is, most sellers believe that that's a huge positive. There's a few sellers, and mostly all buyers, that actually think the opposite. Because if you have four customers that are all 25% of your business, or one customer that's 80% of your business, and you lose that customer, you have no business. So as much as it's good to have customers that are a huge revenue for you, the rule of thumb is you never really want to have, and this is not only a rule of thumb in selling, but this is a rule of thumb from banking as well. You do not want to have one customer that's more than 20% of your business. So what happens if you do, you want to sell? On most of the deals that I have seen where one customer is an overwhelming majority or two customers are overwhelming majority of the revenue, there's usually some sort of earnout or contingency that's in place. And I'll give you an example. If a business sells for $1 million and there's a high concentration of customers, an offer may look as follows. I'll pay you $1 million for the business. I give you $600,000 down, and the remaining $400,000 I'll give you on an earnout, assuming that the sales and profitability in the next 2 years hold tight, locking the large customers into place. I've seen that many, many times. A seller is never going to like that, and I fully understand that. I wouldn't either, but sometimes that's the only way that a buyer will feel comfortable enough that that business won't leave the company that they're buying.
Okay, good advice. Now, we've kind of touched on deal killers a little bit already, but I'd like to kind of go into it just a little bit more. For example, I was working with someone a few years back who was in the middle of selling their business, and they had some prospective buyers on the line, and it looked like they were going to sell it quite well or quite easily. And right in the middle of that whole process, they found out that an employee that was a key financial employee was embezzling a lot of money, and one of their other key employees took off with three or four crew members, and really just everything that could possibly go wrong in the middle of the sale transaction went wrong. And I'm sure you've seen all kinds of things. So maybe you could tell us a few stories that would be educational for the business owners that are listening of what you've kind of seen and what the business owner can kind of do to mitigate those risks during the process of trying to sell their business.
Absolutely. Just like we discussed that it's not good to have one customer with a huge amount of a percentage of revenue, I'll give you an example where one employee held the keys to the kingdom. We were selling a staffing business, and the company did about $2 million a year, and it only had one salesperson, and he did all the revenue, had all the relationships. And when the buyer decided to buy the business, he wanted to meet with the salesperson since he was the whole business. The buyer and seller had come to a deal. They'd agreed on a deal, price, terms, everything. But when the buyer met with the salesperson was not willing to transfer over to the comp plan of the new company, and that deal fell apart. And frankly, there wasn't really much that could be done. And it's a learning lesson that not only can customers hold you hostage, but your employees can hold you hostage as well. That's one example. Another example, and this is unfortunate because it was a last minute and it had nothing to do with the buyers or the sellers. And remember I said there's 20 or 30 different things that can go wrong in a deal. Here's one of them. We were selling a business, had an SBA loan. The SBA loan was for 10 years. The SBA policy is the buyer of a business that gets an SBA loan must have a lease in accordance with the length of the loan. The landlord would not provide a 10-year lease to the buyer. No matter what he did, he wouldn't provide it. they finally figured out a way to get around that. And this same landlord has to sign basically a subordination agreement on the assets in the business. So if the SBA is making a loan, they're going to take collateral of all the assets in the business. Well, a lot of landlords, they want first collateral on all the assets in case they don't pay the rent. The landlord would not sign a subordinate agreement to the assets, and that deal fell apart using SBA financing, and it had to turn out to be owner financing. So luckily, that deal was saved, but it could have easily folded if the seller wasn't flexible. And I could go on and on. I've got a story about an old Red Sox Yankees signed picture that was in a seller's office that was not excluded on the asset list, specifically excluded, and the buyer and the seller, this is a $2.5 million deal, the seller killed the deal, or the buyer, depending on how you want to look at it, because that one painting was not included. I mean, I've seen